Merci à l'INHA et à la Fondation Terra de nous avoir invités. Et mes excuses, nos excuses pour nous exprimer en anglais. Ceci est dû au fait que c'est un projet collaboratif dont les collaborateurs sont pour plusieurs Américains et aux États-Unis, et que nous avons échangé avec eux sur ce paper en anglais. This paper will address the way in which the American West was displayed at the Paris Exposition of 1867 and the extent to which new aesthetic values associated with the West transformed pre-existing perceptions of a land of plenty and promise. So this paper is part of a larger project on the American participation in that fair, which I'm co-directing with Gary Vanzanti, curator at the MIT Museum. And a number of people really would have to be acknowledged, but I will limit myself to the Paris Diderot students who have followed this project for 2 years now. Jessica Talley, who is co-author of the paper, but she could not be with us today, she's still in California. Clémence Guy, who will be here, speak with me. Manuel Sauvage, who has provided extensive field research for the project, and several others from the Masters 2 seminar. And also, I should say that this is going to be perhaps less about appropriation and more about display, and there'll be fewer Indians in this paper. So the second exposition of the French Second Empire brought together 50,000 exhibitors from 32 countries and attracted 11 million visitors. Historian Volker Barth calls it, I quote, "the most consistent attempt ever made to literally create a world exhibition. An almost perfect example of what Michel Foucault defined as heterotopia." I quote again, Foucault this time, "a kind of effectively enacted utopia in which the real sites, all the other real sites that can be found within the culture, are simultaneously represented, contested, and inverted," end quote. So this expo attempted to cover everything, everywhere. Europe, the Americas, Africa, and Asia competed in all fields of endeavor, from industry to fine art, but also social organizations and cultural heritages, in a vision of technical and social progress that centered on labor. The displays were arranged inside the gigantic elliptical palace, following a double pattern, geographic and encyclopedic, materializing two prescribed readings: comparative surveys of a given group, if you followed one of the rings, from the outer wing with the Gallery of Labor and Machines to the fine arts at the center, of course, around the inner garden, and complete images of nations, if you followed a wedge from outer ring to inner garden. The surrounding Champ de Mars was a landscape park with dozens of national pavilions, which would become a staple of later world fairs, along with thematic and pleasure features. Also included for the first time were live performances by ethnic subjects, though not human zoos in the sense of later fairs. The Second Empire intended this expo to demonstrate to the world the power of a modernized but pacific nation, the success of its mixture of laissez-faire and social paternalism, the happy wedding of art and industry. Notice here, of course, the neoclassical patterns of the arches and of the decorative pattern motifs, and the preeminence of French taste. In this French scheme, the U.S., which had been a latent enemy in the French-Mexican War, was only a second-tier player, as evidenced by the size and placement of the American wedge. If you can see it, it's quite, and this is largely magnified so that you can see the little American wedge. But from the viewpoint of American organizers, the exposition appeared in this early moment. Oh, here's another view of the wedge. This is a photograph that Clémence did at the Cooper Hewitt Museum, and a wonderful album of photographs from the fair that we're going to be relying on a lot. It shows again how small the U.S. exhibits were. So for the American organizers, the expo was a unique opportunity to recreate and display a national image in proportion to America's ambitions towards European markets and public opinion, politely bowing to Western Europe's cultural hegemony, but staking out a claim for American progress. Organization of the fair was chaotic and polemical in the US. The overall extent and coherence of what the Americans did manage to send and show was just disappointing by many in Paris as well as at home. Nonetheless, the 1,800 and some American exhibits offered a large array of things: machinery, railroad equipment, steam engines, sewing machines, telegraph apparatus, safes, and so on. Cultural artifacts such as the famous pianos, the Steinway pianos, books, education, scientific instruments. Natural resources, we'll come back to that, and a sizable set of paintings and a great many photographs. Most impressive were three major organizational exhibits, one of which each of which received a grand prize, the transatlantic cable, the U.S. Sanitary Commission, and as an example of social harmony, the Massachusetts Textile Factory Pacific Mills. The exposition was considered a great success on the American side, with a total of 5 grand prizes, 17 gold medals, 75 silver medals, and so on, out of a total of about 20,000 awards. Earning the U.S. the highest ratio of awards, nonetheless, to exhibitors after France, as Nelson Beckwith, the Commissioner General for the U.S., noted here in his report. Meanwhile, at the American Café, Parisian diners had not always enjoyed the food, but the soda fountain became a fad, while African-American waiters drew a lot of attention. And several, this is my mention of Indians, several groups of Native Americans apparently performed informally, though we have not yet been able to really substantiate this story. Thanks to Agathe Cabot for the plate. Our goal in the project is to document and reconstruct as fully as possible the participation of the U.S. in its medial representations, material and archival traces, and social, economic, cultural reverberations. Our general argument concurs with Volker Barth's emphasis on the so-called multiple semantic structures of the exposition. More specifically, I quote, "the simultaneity of overlapping medial entities and the diverse perceptual practices that these gave rise to," end quote. Excluding any simplistic reading of the exposition as mere copy of the outside real world, or as staged ideological discourse on the part of one or another power. The exposition is characterized by a series of ruptures between the intentions and the medial structures that embodied them, between the medial structures and public perceptive practices, between an illusion of total control by organizers and what Barth calls the creative element inherent in visitors' imaginations and memories, a creative element that echoes to a certain extent the notion of appropriation. Leaving, therefore, the simplistic notion of success aside, we question the American presence at the Expo as a complex discordant, to use Christophe Charles' term in his book on French modernity, moment of American modernity, condensing a long process of emergence, in quotation marks, of the U.S. in the larger trends of globalization, a process in which we explore, among other aspects, the enactment of an aesthetic appeal. This concern with aesthetics derives in part from our earlier research on the circulation of photographs in the 19th century. More directly, it registers the preeminence of art, and I think you saw that, for instance, here, and the ubiquity of photography and visual communication in the Second Empire's heterotopia. I will now introduce aesthetics and economics as a governing duality of discourse on the American displays, first in a general way before focusing on the West. To bring up the notion of a Western aesthetics or even of an American aesthetics in the context of Second Empire France is a provocation of sorts. By 1867, as Jacques Porte and Philippe Roger, among others, have shown, much influential French opinion was once again on the downside of its reticent fascination with America, and even Tocquevillians such as Duvergier de Oran, the journalist, did not avoid the dominant cliché that American culture was in short practical and business-minded, but tasteless and showy. As the journalist Duvergier wrote, Americans could be compared to their machines, and I'll let you read the rest of that quote. But the cultural critique of America went much further. Philippe Hamon, the literary historian, has explored the phrase American image américaine, American images, as a generic label for all kinds of images, ranging from Barnum-type shows to facile literary metaphors. That manifested all sorts of images that manifested negative aesthetic values, commercialism, vulgarization, naivete, effect, associated either metaphorically or by a loose causal link with America. But for the French post-romantic avant-garde, America, was much worse than that. It simply stood for modernity and its discontents. The Universal Expositions in general were lambasted as triumphs of matter and Americanization, a term coined by Charles Baudelaire in the context of the 1855 fair and echoed in 1867 in the poet's last very somber pages, as well as in the diary of his little Goncourt brothers. Meanwhile, Gustave Flaubert wrote to George Sand that at the 1867 exposition, he thought the whole time of America and felt like speaking Negro, as if identifying with an oppressed minority, as earlier and later romantics had also with American Indians, precisely at the time when the U.S., as a simultaneously racialist and newly multiracial civic society, was emerging as an alternative model for imperial France. In 1867, the exposition was bound to reflect such influential opinion. In March, ahead of the opening, the popular L'Illustration declared, "It is not with luxury items of art or art objects that the American Union will shine. Nobody will say the contrary," etc. The U.S. Commissioner Nelson Beckwith, a longtime Paris resident, had interiorized this aesthetic complex from the start. In his final post-expo overview, he could only repeat it. "The high position of American industrial products in the jury's opinions was," he said, "not due in general to graceful design, fertile combinations of pleasing colors, etc., but it is owing to their skillful, direct, and admirable adaptation of the great ones that they want to supply." Obvious evidence for Beckwith's thesis, for Beckwith's aesthetic complex, is the poor rating given to the American Fine Arts Exhibition, the largest display of the kind presented to date in Europe, and to this day, about the only part of the U.S. participation to this expo with a significant historiographical trail. Despite the artist's medal awarded to Frederick Church's Niagara and the attention raised by Jim McNeil Whistler's White Girl, this show excited few comments, and those were mostly negative, an attitude of ignorance that is perfectly captured in the vantage point chosen by the exposition stereographers Léon and Lévy in their two views of the display, where we notice, besides the statue of Napoleon I defeated by Long Thompson, James Artemus Ward's Indian Hunter now in Central Park. But of course, you can't see in these stereographs anything about the painting exhibition. Ernest Chenault, secretary of the jury for Class One, concluded in 1868 that the American school was, I quote, "laboriously trailing behind the English school, though he grouped it, following the geopolitically determined layout of the palace, with the schools of the South." To Chenault, save for a few examples of boldness, such as Church's Niagara and Bierstadt's Rocky Mountains, the only picture of the West that can be said to be of the West in this show, "most American landscapes are," I quote Chenault again, "are painted in a spirit of convention that is surprising in a nation that is supposed to have freed itself of so many other conventions." In Carol Tryon's classic analysis, her article is entitled Innocence Abroad, this confirms that American artists, obsessed with recognition from Paris and inspired by academic masters for the most part, were still innocents abroad, like the characters of Mark Twain's novel, who, by the way, visit the fair during their great excursion to Europe. Though the expo also witnessed the rise, this is Troyan's argument still, of a new generation, less interested in grand-style landscape than in small genre pictures, and groping for a proto-impressionist style. Troyan also noted the discordant voice of Théophile Thoré, great champion of realism. "The Americans have no art. Well, all the better. They won't be hampered to create new art, and it is well possible that the boys of Freedom's Nation might start one of these days to create surprising paintings." We cannot prolong this conversation here, but Thoré's opposition to Chenault's bemusement at the conventionality of self-proclaimed non-conventionals points to the multiple perceptions I mentioned earlier, and which the displays from the West elicited more particularly. As a transition to these Western displays, I will discuss one object that captured maximal attention among the machinery exhibits, the America locomotive and tender of the Grant and Patterson Works of New Jersey. So here we have the front, here we have the back. This is in the American Annex. You see the McCormick Reapers on the right. And so this was the main attraction in the Annex, and it became one of the iconic American objects. Built in the East, this is an engraving from L'Exposition Illustrée, built in the East, this locomotive's destiny was with the great westward expansion. It was put into service after the fair on the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific, which linked Chicago with the eastern terminus of the Pacific Railroad in Omaha. Mechanically, it exhibited no major innovations, but it was adapted to the rough, unequal conditions of American railway travel. It was lighter, more flexible, faster. Its set of small front wheels could negotiate sharper curves. Its wheel of cast iron were hollow. It featured a powerful headlight and a cow catcher, that also served as snowplow. All of this was very striking to the French viewers. And its cab was a fully closed and outfitted cabin from which all operations of the engine could be commanded. These features in themselves readily matched imaginations of difficult terrains, long distances, rough encounters, popularized already by some narratives of travel. But what made the America truly iconic was its extraordinary amount of ornamentation, which made it, according to one testimonial of the time, a poem in iron and silver. And in the words of a recent historian, possibly, I quote, the most fulsomely decorated engine ever put on American rails. The many illustrations we have are monochrome and only give us an idea of its appearance, although, unlike other railway queens of the period, it was probably less colorful than shiny, with its plating in German silver. Coming from America. It became known as the silver engine. And so the descriptions of the cab are just tremendous. The cab was crafted of ash, maple, black walnut, mahogany, and cherry. The boiler, smokestack, valve boxes, and cylinders were covered with a glistening silvery material. The tender was decorated with the arms of the Republic, a portrait of Ulysses Grant, which you don't see here, that was on the tender, and a number of scrolls, and etc. This, then, was an unusual case of a showy but not gaudy American product, masking not exactly humbug or dollar thirst, but excellent mechanics and perfect environmental adaptation. The French official report almost excused its public success, explained by shapes, he said, unusual in Europe, a coquetterie that contrasts with the modest simplicity of our locomotives. The elegant cab of the mechanic was also noted. A French engineer who investigated railroad equipment wrote that it was the engine that had, I quote, the most appearance, le plus d'apparence, on account of its diversity of coloring, the shine of all its pieces, admirably polished and finished. Here's the plates of the engineer where you see the America compared to some other European locomotives. The writer who covered American exhibits for L'Exposition Illustrée, one named we don't know his first name, Malespine, who appears to have been on U.S. government payroll during the Civil War to, Stephen Knott, appears to be on a payroll to influence European opinion to support the Union, and clearly was a secret agent, was ecstatic. It is a monster and it is a beauty, a hell and a jewel. William Blake, the state commissioner for California, who also edited the General American Reports, and authored the report on steam engineering, made a point of claiming this coquetry as a positive, substantial American improvement over the choice of continental minds, the majority of whom are imbued with exceedingly plain ideas on the subject of locomotive ornamentation. I don't have time to go into this discussion of locomotive ornamentation, but it has become a topic in technological and cultural history. John Kasson in Civilizing the Machine has pointed out the fact that even back in the US, engineering culture was very divided about this tendency to decorate machines in every possible way. However, in the case of the, and so we have on the right here a quote from the Scientific American from 67, who says that it was not perhaps necessary to decorate it so much. However, the French commentary was rather positive, or at least neutral. This aesthetics, so I want to conclude here with the fact that what it matters more is that the America's aesthetics in its silver and fine wood outfit, and in its later after image as the silver engine in the West, displayed in photographs and engravings situated in woodsy settings, is a fitting introduction for a discussion of what we call an environmental aesthetics of the American West. This aesthetics was an American invention, even a form of boosterism, not a French appropriation. But it lent itself easily to French acceptance. It had two major characteristics. It was not gaudy, but it was functional or motivated, and it transformed the economic and social appeal of the new lands into a form of art. So I'm going to pass here to give the floor to Clémence just to say that similar comments could be made about two other sets of exhibits at the Paris World Fair. The agricultural machinery, especially the reapers and mowers, which you see typically illustrated in these agricultural, if not bucolic, environments, and also the houses, the American houses in the park, which were primarily exhibited by the state of Illinois, the American farm, and the American school, which, according to Malespine, our secret envoy, were humble cabins whose greatness is wholly moral, and who symbolized the birth of a future as well as the whole strength of the U.S. And Malespine took care to contrast them to what was in the park next to them, especially that amazing Mexican temple that dwarfs the little American houses in the foreground of these views. And next to the Mexican temple was an Egyptian palace, a Turkish Bosphorus house, etc. So the American houses were really offset, even in a sort of negative way, by all this Oriental splendor. So let's just move on to the displays that came from further west and the way that these displays strongly solicited French appropriation.